Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined as always by Justin Young.
Andrew,
this is great. You want to play Bryce? Do you want to play me?
Yeah. Hey, I'm Justin Robert Young. And
of course, Brian Brushwood.
Oh man, I'm stuck with the dumb role. Why you always got to make me the Brian?
Your typecast is Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, man. Boo.
This is weird. Don't worry, folks. Andrew is currently in Florida.
He's on assignment. In Florida. Mm-hmm.
I was able to escape. I got out of Florida on the same day he came in, and apparently I left quite a mess, and he is still cleaning it up. So he will be back next week, but we are going to suffer without him today.
Well, and actually, it's not so much us suffer. We're going to have a great time. It's you guys that are going to have to suffer without his expertise.
We are sorry ahead of
this
time.
Episode is what we're saying. Just go ahead and just shut it off.
Skip it. Go ahead. All things considered. Go.
Yeah, listen to S-Town.
So
maybe
this
listeners,
this was an astonishingly busy week. I remember I told the story of being out in L.A. and finding the dead sea lion. The adventures didn't stop there. I went to Las Vegas in time for – oh, man, this is a weird thing. Did you hear about this windstorm in Vegas?
No.
No, the cool thing about having – a large group of your friends be magicians is that you are always up on the inside outs of local Vegasness.
Like, yes! If
you get local Vegas things pop up. LA, Vegas, New York are just, I know a lot about it, the locality, but yeah, this was a huge thing. I mean, this was like winds that were ripping things off and really wreaking havoc throughout Las Vegas.
Yeah, it was wild too, because like I'm trying to get back into being fit. And so I was staying downtown at the Plaza, which is the hotel from Back to the Future 2, the one that they dressed up as Biff's casino. That's the Plaza Hotel. That's where I was downtown. Mm-hmm. And I ran the numbers and it would be like 11 miles to go from downtown all the way to the bottom of the strip at Mandalay Bay. And I was like, well, that'll be a fun, you know, I'll jog a couple miles and I'll walk the rest. And so I got started and it was beautiful. Got a little windy, kind of walking into the wind, and it was a little rough. And then at some point, by the time I got to Mandalay Bay, like 2.5-3 hours later, my phone is buzzing with alerts saying gusts up to 60 miles an hour, seek shelter.
Gosh.
Later, gusts hit 80 miles an hour. And it was like that scene from Mad Max. You just watched a wall of dust come rolling in over the city. The sky vanished, and you started seeing trees start flopping over. It was utterly unreal. Eventually, an entire street's worth of power lines were felled. Like the wooden poles snapped. It was hurricane force winds.
Just general winds, not even like good.
Like no rain, no hail, no frogs.
Correct. The slightest amount of drizzle mixed with dust. Like when I closed my mouth and bit my teeth down, I heard the crunch of dust
of
in my mouth. Yeah.
Wow.
And the weirdest part was during all this, Chris Minton and I, Mitzula, we were trying to find a place to grab a bite to eat. So we duck into this one hotel casino for like long enough to take the elevator up to the top to get a good view of the chaos going down. And then we're like, nah, let's go to another place. We go down, we walk out, and in 15 minutes, it had dropped like 20 degrees. It was utterly surreal. Like everything shut down. My favorite thing is if you look at hashtag Vegas wind, you'll see a bunch of photos of that stuff, but you'll also encounter my favorite sequence of tweets in which, tweet one is some chick saying, calm down, y'all. It's just windy. God. Tweet two is that same person saying, so a tree fell in my house. And tweet three is the local news saying tree falls in house of local woman.
Amazing.
Oh, my gosh.
So what was the reaction? What was it like one of those, like, you know, all TV stations locally are news? Like, was it like a tornado or a hurricane? Like, or was everybody just like, I don't know, man, there's just some wind.
There was a lot of chatter about, you know, hey, man, be safe out there. This is no joke, that kind of stuff. And it's weird, the little things in this 21st century age that it matters. Like, obviously, those power lines got down, or maybe they were telephone lines.
Or ponchos.
The wild thing was that they replaced all those power lines in a matter of like 3 or 4 hours, but they replaced the wood ones with metal ones.
And
we were trying to figure that out, and the best we could figure is
because they would usually normally do wood because they break easier.
Well,
if you crash into them, they're less damaged than a metal one, I would believe.
I assume, but as best I could figure, maybe they bought a bunch of the metal poles and they're like, well, we're not going to go
to a warehouse.
Well, yeah. Because they need replacement poles. Yeah. And they're all like, well, we're not going to go tear down all the wood poles. We'll just wait till they break. And as they break, we'll replace them with metal poles.
Yeah.
But during that time, we went to go eat for dinner and they were all like, cash only. And it's like, why? And they're like, because we can't get a telephone line to connect to.
The card machines blew away.
Exactly. And I'm like, dude, Square Cash, guys, what are you doing?
Yeah,
Square.
Just 3G connection, my dude.
But it was a trip. And
so how long did this last? Like an hour?
Oh, that was the
hours?
Other thing. Yeah. So it started around, I want to say, 2 or 3 o'clock was when it got real bad, and it was super intense for like 4 hours, and it never really stopped, but you started being able to see sky around 7, and then it just kept on going. Later, my flights got insanely delayed, and it was like a refugee camp. Like, it was supposed to be a 1 a.m. flight, but then they didn't announce the delay until after everyone was there and all the businesses were closed down.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, 3 hours, enjoy yourselves. And so there's no food, no water, no nothing. And it's like it's like a church lock-in, just bodies laying down everywhere and one dude playing a slot machine at 3 a.m.
That's amazing.
It was crazy, though. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Was there any other thing that you saw on the news or in general? Like, there were a few, like, you know, like signs that were like half ripped down that just kind of looked like these like ominous omens or like the Fallout game or something like that.
There was one thing that happened over and over and over again. It was an epidemic across all of Vegas. What do you think got flipped up and flung around more than anything else?
Those flippy boards that people flip around when they want you to go to a cell phone store.
Nope.
That'd be pretty great.
Fanny packs. Dude holding on tight.
To save me.
Exactly. I just imagine some, like, you know, hacky, like, you know, he's like flips it up and it just like leaves. It's like, oh, I guess that's an early lunch.
Like. No, dude, it is trampolines flying everywhere because like the winds usually aren't that bad, but like just everybody has trampolines flying all the way around everywhere.
Oh, geez. I guess like they are, if there is enough wind, they are just, you know, sails, right? Like, you know, they are there to fly free.
And plus also it's the kind of thing that you would never think to lock down, but you would have to have extraordinary, look at these extraordinary like winds.
Bent around a telephone pole.
Trampolines are in Vegas. Jesus.
I think they're like pools. It's you get up in an airplane, you're like, wow, a lot of people have trampolines.
Probably pretty cheap, right? If you lose one, no big deal. It's pretty light. It's probably not going to cause too much damage, maybe.
Yeah, dude.
Wait a minute. Bryce, let's say you get a house, right?
Sure.
You got a little space in the backyard.
Let's fantasize a future where I can own a house, yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, what do I put in there? Like, is it like a little pool bar, right? You know, maybe an above ground pool. Let's say you don't have money to put a below ground pool. You're not digging a pool, right? Didn't come with one.
Sure.
You got space in the backyard. Like, at what point you're like, oh, geez, trampoline. Trampoline's the way to go.
I mean, pretty quick, if you ask me.
If you have kids, like, kids love trampolines.
Well, you have a house and you have kids and you do not have a trampoline.
Wait.
Brock.
First of all, we have a bounce house that Bonnie will sometimes. Oh, I guess we got a tiny trampoline, a little tiny one. But we have an inflatable. You know, to rent a bounce house, it's like $200 or to buy a bounce house, it's like $250.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we just bought a bounce house like a decade ago. And every so often, Bonnie will just decide to be the best mom ever. And she'll clear all the furniture out of the living room and just inflate this
inside,
thing.
Inside?
Yeah, in the living room.
With the big wind machine?
Yes, yes. And the kids go nuts. It's freaking great. And they're watching TV bouncing on this thing. So yeah, we're covered in that department.
Yeah.
Hold on, wait a minute. Bryce, how many things can you list that you would want in your backyard before an oversized, like, pro-style trampoline?
Pro-style? I would say full-size.
Because that's what, like, those are. For everybody listening on audio, we're not talking about some little, like, 1980s aerobics, you know, personal trampoline. This is one of those that you and two friends can all jump up and down.
This is one where you get the double bounce and one of you guys nearly goes over the barrier and breaks a neck and stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, how many things would I have before? I mean, like, patio furniture and maybe a barbecue, I guess. Like, those are the only things I can think of that are not, like, nailed
down.
Man,
I'd be bouncing. I'd order in barbecue, and I would just bounce and I'd look at the stars, lay down on a trampoline at night.
Wait, you're a fraud. You are a fraud. You are the only person who has backyard space, and you do not have this.
Well, I told you, we got the bounce house. Plus, we had the giant potato chip, which I think counts. Like, that would have been flying all around.
Potato chip?
Yeah, you don't remember the giant potato chip? Giant rocking yellow thing in the backyard.
Yeah.
You can see it on satellite imagery.
Which is funny because, like, you guys do have pretty high winds out where you guys are. Like, it can get pretty windy out there in the beginnings of Texas hill country, right?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Well, and plus, like, we're kind of on the side of a hill, so it's like a wind corridor, and it's better now that a lot of the trees have grown in. But, like, when we first moved there, it was like just a howling wind tunnel at all times.
Mm. But you want to know what else is howling? Everybody who supports us at patreon.com/weirdthings, they're howling that this episode sucks.
No, they're amazed by our firsthand accounts of wacky weather.
Do you think the winds are the sign of an evil scientist?
Yeah, sure. Oh, but and
who
of course,
was trying to take over Vegas.
By the way, nobody could resist. There's somebody like, oh, crazy winds. I guess climate change isn't real, huh, what? Republicans? And I'm just like, Jesus, don't be that guy. What are you doing? Yeah, man, 403 patrons keeping us loud, live, and independent. We are just $6 away from being at a sweet, sweet half grand an episode. So if you would please be our BFF and contribute, then we could get up to, you know, I don't know, what, five patrons, six patrons? You can make 20% of the difference. Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings and make our dreams come true.
Hmm. Our dreams are a trampoline.
We're going to buy a trampoline. See, think about it. By the end of a month, each of us can have a trampoline.
Right.
Uh-huh. All four of us.
In the studio, and it'll never blow away. Makes you think, IMO.
We're just bouncing the whole time, and we're kind of dipping in and out.
It'd be pretty great, not going to lie. Hey, man, since we last did an episode, SpaceX, I don't know, created the dawn of true commercial space flight.
Huh? What do you mean?
it's a good TF. Yeah, no, thank you. Bump, set, spike. No.
Also, by the way, that was all right. No, that's Night Attack is where we attack each other's transitions. Not this learned back and forth. Yes, they did. They indeed did.
Did you watch it live?
I did not watch it live, like physically there. I wound up having to do DTNS, and I wasn't able to get out to where I could get a good vantage point. So I just decided to watch it right there on my phone, like everybody else. I was eating a Wawa sub in Altamont Springs, Florida, and man, it was kind of like it was a moment. It was definitely something that I was very, very kind of blown away by, especially considering sort of how far this company has come and how fast they've done it.
Yeah, it really does seem like just yesterday, although it was 7 years ago. 7 years ago that I was in Orlando, we were doing weird things and arguing about space elevators versus reusable rockets, and I was wrong. In fact, the moment Andrew called afterwards, I answered the phone saying, I was wrong, you were right, I was wrong, you were right. And, space elevator, not the best thing to focus on, reusable rockets for the win. And he wisely pointed out, like, hey, man, I want both. Like, sure. We can do both.
Well, and also it's easier to build the space elevator once you have cheaper rockets that can go up, you know, at a different price. what is the – all right, so here's my big hot take sports talk radio question.
Yeah.
Greatest scientific achievement of our lifetime?
No. Possibly the greatest engineering achievement of our lifetime.
Okay. What's in the realm of big S?
Yeah. Well, that's tough though, because you're looking at advancements in gigabit technology and DNA stuff. I guess those would be scientific advancements. This way, but as far as an engineering feat, I would make a comment about how it came and went quietly, but I don't think it came and went very quietly. I think a lot of people get how big a deal this is and how exciting it is.
Well, it's just the story of SpaceX has been kind of you are always forever in one of two camps. You're excited and you believe that they will continue their momentum, or you're waiting for them to prove a milestone, right? And that's kind of always been what it is. Well, can they get a rocket up? Okay, they can. Can they get a rocket up sustainably? Okay, they can. Can they be a reliable transporter for the U.S. government? Because that's really how you make the money. Yes, they can. Can they break the political monopoly of, you know, of Boeing and Lockheed and the like that have monopolized this space for forever? Yes, they can. Can they do reusable? Or no, can they land the rocket? Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, can they relaunch a rocket that has already gone up once? Yes.
Well, so, and you left out the middle stage, because first there was, can they reland the rocket? And the first success was on land. Was like, can we do it on a barge out at sea? And the answer is still yes.
And even then, the normalization of that, like, now we know very, very surely that SpaceX can land a rocket with a pretty good percentage rate. Now it's going to be, can they launch and land reusable rockets at that same, you know, reliability rate or not? And the answer is probably yes.
Yes. Well, but
that's something that's going to unfold over time.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, when you play certain games, like we'll say Hearthstone, or I'm sure this is true for like Monopoly or whatever, once you get a revenue generating property, the mere fact of your previous success starts to fuel all the future successes, and you just become overbalanced in being able to provide, get so much money coming in, you can't believe it. And I think that's where we're headed, because I mean, that's what do they have? They have four spaceships, one of which has now gone up twice. And of course, these are just the first stage of the rocket. But now, like, theoretically, they could just keep on being in service while they continue to make more and more rockets. And this thing just goes in a constant conveyor belt here. My biggest disappointment that Andrew is not here is because I have a bunch of questions. And so without Andrew here, maybe I'll ask them and we'll see how fast Bryce can find the answer.
Sure. Oh, I can guess too.
Or you can just make it up. That's fine. For all I know, Andrew's been doing that the entire time.
Exactly.
It's all confidence.
I remember hearing that not only did they successfully land the first stage of the rocket, but the fairing for the second stage had they are now attempting to figure out how to get that to land.
That was the tweet afterward, because like any good wrestling promoter, Elon Musk always promotes the next fight after one successful. So he said, yeah, that now that they have done that, the next big challenge is to land the second stage as well.
Well, and they even did some rudimentary tests. Like, they knew it was going to crash, but they were able to get it to crash in a close area. Right?
This is Elon Musk's tweet. Considering trying to bring upper stage back on Falcon Heavy demo flight for full reusability, odds of success low, but maybe worth a shot.
So this is before the launch or
after?
After. Okay. I could have sworn there was some kind of actual experiment that was happening during it. But I may have misread that. I'm pretty sure.
There was. It was the relaunching of a previously used rocket for the first time.
No, but there was like a lesser experiment that
was
going on at the
same time. Secret dark science.
A more rudimentary experiment.
Well, I mean, it is worth noting that they landed it again, right? That they successfully landed it again on a barge. So now, you know, theoretically, that could be the first three-time, you know, the rocket used three time, depending on what their refurb schedule is. The big question here, and let's be critical, we're not just SpaceX fanboys here, is we do not know how much it costs to refurb. And the whole point of this is that you are rapidly taking down the price per launch. We presume that it costs less than making a totally new rocket, right? But we do not know, A, if it is, and B, exactly how much.
Well, he had previously said that eventually it should be 50% the cost of a regular launch to get it up and running. But he said starting with the very first success, it will be 30% off the top immediately. Now, of course, that's so, not yeah, this is him. Him making a claim is not the same as revealing numbers.
March 2016, the SpaceX president Gwynne Shotwell said, "Yeah, it translated to a 30% price reduction."
His name is Shotwell.
Yeah, Gwynne Shotwell.
Well, yeah, the CEO.
A 30% president. 30% price reduction to customers would drop Falcon's advertised $42.8 million to $42.8 million from then's $61.2 million.
It's pretty huge.
Those were projections. And also, there is something to be said for them possibly overspending to make sure that this was a success. Because a demonstrable, a feat like this is something that is obviously, you can't put a price on it, right? Yeah. Like you would prefer that happen, even if it means spending maybe more than you would going forward when this becomes a regular thing. But let's not mince words here on the momentous element of this achievement. I mean, the idea that space travel, that access to space could be, according to their own words, 30% cheaper today and up to 50% cheaper within the next few years that opens up pardon the pun, but like a galaxy of other opportunities of people that would like to do stuff that I've just simply been priced out.
And, in this 2016 article, the first stage engines, they say, can be used dozens of times, which is, every launch is going to just bring that number down in terms of cost per flight.
And keep in mind, future models. Still at Work in the chat room has a very good point. It says, you will likely not see much reduction in price. SpaceX is already the cheapest, as they need to make some profit to earn back the $1 billion they've invested in R&D, mm-hmm. which is a pretty good point. I mean, they've earned that margin if their margins just got, a lot bigger.
Yes, and what I think we are going to see is, and SpaceX has kind of made a meal out of this since they started, is exactly how inflated those prices are previously for rockets. And, depending on how much they are, I'd be like, yes, they are the cheapest, but we do not, and yes, you're probably not going to see a tremendous reduction in price immediately because Elon Musk and Gwynne Shotwell have both said that they do need to recoup money at this point.
Right.
But I still think that they will be markedly cheaper if even by a fraction of their, a fraction off what they're currently charging, just because, here's the big story out of this is that, the people that were supplying rockets to us did not have a tremendous incentive to innovate much.
Yeah, this you're throwing shade at you're not throwing shade, but the ULA, Boeing and Lockheed were the de facto monopoly on sending stuff to orbit. And I'm just going to go out on a limb, and I have no basis for this. I'm going to bet that while they did fine work that was reliable, I'm going to bet a little bit pricey.
They are literally the military industrial complex as described by Eisenhower, right? That there's not. There's a whole business based on the idea that you are making these things and you want to make these things and you want to charge this money because that's the business. You are a government contractor and that's what you do. There's not a whole lot of incentive. If somebody walks in and says, hey, I got a way to make this thing cheaper, internally they'll be like, yes, more profit, but they're not going to be like, and we'll pass on the savings to America. It's just not a thing that's said.
Right. Okay. In all of our discussions about going to space and doing this and all this other stuff, space tourism and all that, it's always been in the realm of fantasy. Looking at this, 20 years from now, I'll be barely 60. And, a lot can change in 20 years. Mm-hmm. In 20 years, they could have hundreds of these at dozens of launch pads going off constantly. Mm-hmm. How cheap do you think we're looking at a tourist flight in space. Let's say a decent job, like a full day experience. Yeah. Go up
like the moon thing. That
like the guys going to the moon and back. How cheap do you think this is going to be in 20 years?
So we're talking about tourism, not like cargo or anything.
Correct. Yeah. Like I just want to go. Like ever since I was a kid, wanted to be an astronaut. Wanted to go to space. Well, yeah, these, yeah, you could get the 5 minute novelty free fall from Virgin, right? Mm-hmm. Or the suborbital flight from Blue Origin. But like, let's say I want to spend a good. I want to take a lap around the planet. How cheap do you think it's going to get?
Well, I mean, so let's start. I mean, what are the projected prices for Blue Origin? I guess. So,
you know what? We should look at commercial flight over time.
So we've got the CS10 Starliner would be about $58 million per seat right now. That's a NASA estimate. We've also got Space Adventures, a travel agency that arranges space journeys, is more than double the cost of the trip to the ISS. That's $175 million per seat. So right now we are in the double digit million. The latest five seats NASA bought in bulk were $74.7 million per seat.
Yeah, I got
it. Those are to the ISS, not necessarily to the moon and or back.
Correct. Or just staying in your capsule, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But in 20 years?
20 years, let's say all they do is start just they have five flights a year, which they're gonna have more than five flights a year, but let's say they make five rockets a year. 20 years from now they've flown and reclaimed, they have a fleet of what's five times of 100 rockets that could be running like every other day. There could be a flight going up at that point.
I feel
Luke,
like
not since 20 years, I'd hope 2,500. I mean, but to put so, 20 years ago,
well, like
1997.
Like now, okay, well, think about like a ride on the Vomit Comet, right? The parabolic flight. You can experience weightlessness for about $5,000 a person. That was simply not possible when I was a kid. And then the mere fact that they used the parabolic flight in order to get those weightless scenes in Apollo 13 was like extraordinary that they were even able to accomplish that. Mm-hmm.
I feel like a million.
You think it down to a million?
I think it plateaus at about a million.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like between the safety regimen you have to go through.
As Andrew pointed out, fuel cost alone, the actual fuel, like let's assume everything's reusable forever.
Sure.
He said that the fuel cost to get to orbit is about $200,000, $250,000, which is roughly what it costs to fly a 777 around the Earth, right? Mm-hmm. So call it a quarter million split. I guess we'd call it a half million. If fuel alone is a quarter million, but then again, energy might be cheaper by then. Wait, sure. Let's be optimistic. Let's say it's a quarter million and there's five seats. I guess yeah, $50,000 per seat. Like that's not insane.
Really? That seems very
cheap. Really, I mean, here's the other big thing that we're kind of seeing is exactly how stagnant this technology was for basically our entire lives. You know, for everybody that was born past the space race, we've kind of just, you know, I mean, what one might say that we stopped dreaming. you know, there's just there has not been this level of rapid iteration, and you just kind of wonder, okay, well, what's the new normal? You know, is what we've experienced over the past 5 years the new normal? Is it faster? Is it slower? Right now, we don't know. I mean, all indications certainly point to the fact that. Now, once we establish this and it is cheaper, that certainly more stuff will go up there, right? I mean, Elon Musk has a very aggressive timeline when it comes to going to Mars and going to the moon and stuff like that and flying people around the moon. There's already tickets booked for it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we will see. But that is, to me, the grand question. And that's really what your hypothetical is kind of begging at, is what is your bet? You know, is your bet super aggressive and super fast, and that means that rapid iteration and continued expansion, now that we have kind of a standardized way that somebody has done it, leads to a tremendous race to put as many things into space with as many different players as possible? Or is it, you know, there's SpaceX and maybe a few other players, and eventually Boeing and Lockheed are going to, you know, rejigger what they're doing and eventually become more, you know, competitive players on this technology, and we'll get it, but it won't be, you know, what we've seen in the last 7 years, where all of a sudden we go from this is impossible to it, LOL, it just happened.
Well, and I guess that's the remarkable moment that I'm having right now, is that this discussion has always been academic and theoretical and a piece of science fiction. And it's fun to know that somebody somewhere is able to buy a ticket, but that's not going to be me. I'm never going to be that rich. But now seeing this happen and knowing how fast things iterate and how quickly, you know, we're on track to be swimming in energy. And it just makes me, for the first time ever, like, I don't know, maybe in my lifetime, maybe I won't be too old. You know, maybe I'm 57 years old and it's finally cheap enough and we've socked away enough that I could do that. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Well, and also, I mean, like, also factor in what life expectancy is and how, you know, how much longer people will in generally be living. You know, that's something that has continued to climb at a pretty steady rate. And who knows, you know, there certainly are a lot of people that are smarter than us that are, you know, banking on radical advancements when it comes to health and aging. So who knows? You know, 50 will be the new 30.
speaking of which, there was another story. I guess we'll have to look up the details. I'm going to tell you the half-baked version I remember.
Okay.
There, I believe it was in Japan, but for the first time, there was a recipient of donor pluripotent stem cells. So they injected into her eyes, I think, to repair retinas or something. There we go. A Japanese man just got another person's stem cells transplanted in his eye. There had been a similar surgery, but it was done with stem cells generated from their own body. This is the first time where they took stem cells from a totally different person and injected it in there. And I'll tell you what, man, stem cells is another thing that sounded like crazy science fiction down the road someday stuff. But there's a guy in our neighborhood who had MS so bad he could not feed himself. And now I see him riding a bike around. It's astonishing.
That was when we were talking about the greatest scientific achievements in our lifetime. My first thought was, well, stem cells could be pretty miraculous if we figure that out.
Yeah, yeah.
In a social context.
Absolutely.
Also, like, you know, listen, all this scholarly book learning is going to be really, really, really awesome when, like, you know, the Earth explodes or gets hit by, you know, some sort of rogue space debris. Like, you know, that's why this to me ranks above anything else, because it benefits. Hey, guess what? More study time if we don't have to be on the Earth when our ticket gets punched here on old blue Earth, right? Like, you know, if we can get to space easier, we can not die easier, which means that we'll have all the time in the world to understand stem cells and sequencing DNA and everything else. Like,
that's one of those things. Like, I think about it in terms of like IT, where it's just like, what? All of the data of all of humanity is on one hard drive? You don't have a RAID? You don't have anything backed up anywhere at all? It's just all on this one disk? Are you guys crazy? And so, you know, I love the idea of, like, let's get out of this Petri dish so that we have a redundant array of independent planets, or a RAPE, as I call it.
Oh, Christ.
No? Oh, sorry. No. Not the best name.
No. Andrew's involuntarily shaking his head.
He's in a swamp somewhere going, oh, I'm not happy with something that just happened.
I do also love the idea that, like, you know, that humanity is effectively constantly in a situation where it's trying to take a photo and just deleting other photos so it can make space for it.
Yeah.
Your planet is almost full of storage. Yeah. Storage now.
Please delete photos.
this was this past week. He had an age-related macular degeneration, a currently incurable eye disease that slowly leads to loss of vision. And they're gonna keep an eye on him,
so to speak,
for about a year, and then checkups for another 3 years. It seems like the thing that they're worried about is rejection of stem cells. I didn't think that is something stem cells necessarily did, because they were more. I mean, part of their the thing that makes them such a potentially amazing tool is that they are very adaptable to the types of human cells that are near them, but mm-hmm. they can still be rejected by the body, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, the body is really good at figuring out anything that looks a little bit weird. And one of the theories about the increase in food allergies recently is, like, in a world where we're not infested by parasites at all the time, an ever vigilant body, this is just a theory, but an ever vigilant body looks around like, peanuts, you guys look awful weird. I think you're poison. Mm-hmm. And so likewise, you know, we know that when you put an organ in, it will be rejected if you don't take anti-rejection medicine. But in this case, you know, down to the cellular level, where you have this pluripotent cell that grows into the stuff around it, you know, that's the question. Is it's not of the body, but will the body ever notice the difference?
Right,
you know?
Because it adapts to what is around it.
Right, and as I understand it, the body will sort of tolerate, like, yeah, you're kind of weird, and at some point it'll just snap and be like, I don't like your face. I don't think you're one of us. Get out. And then trouble.
Jeez.
Yeah. Anyway, that was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Hey, Justin.
Hey. Yeah, what's up, man?
Which animals do you think would consume the flesh of all of humanity the fastest?
One,
actually, I don't even know that this is the fastest, but there's a fact that I learned thanks to the ancient scrolls before he died and ascended to heaven. Andrew left behind the scrolls.
Oh, wow. The Andrew scrolls.
That's exactly.
A well-known thing that he does is he dictates the knowledge of the universe into his glowing set of scrolls. Yeah.
There is a living thing on planet Earth that can, yep, if all of these living things teamed up and they had a taste for human flesh,
mm-hmm, yeah,
could consume all of humanity, the entire population of the Earth.
Seven, eight billion people.
In less than a year. And still be hungry and go back to eating what they usually eat.
All right. So, I mean, the one thing that we would normally say is snakes, right? Like, is it snakes? I'm going to go ahead and say snakes, but I don't think that that's true because, you know, they're not known for being voracious eaters, right? Like, they're kind of leisurely diners, the snakes.
We're seeing maggots. We're seeing ants in the chat room.
Huge pink diamond. Some form of bacteria. That's a good one. This is a Washington Post article that I'll give you a hint. If you tallied them all up, they would weigh as much as 478 Titanics. So picture 478 of the Titanic.
29 million tons.
I'll give you a hint. There is a 100% chance that there is one in your home.
Birds. Oh, God.
They recently – yeah, they're birds. No, they recently did a survey, and a survey of North Carolina turned up these critters in 100% of homes in North Carolina, including 68% of bathrooms and more than three-quarters of bedrooms.
I'm going to say that I don't know, but I would like to say lizards.
Lizards. You think lizards are in 100% of North Carolina homes?
I don't know. Have you ever been around? I mean, there's a lot of lizards in Florida. Maybe I'm projecting, but lizards are normally all over the place.
Kakalaki's got some lizards, yeah.
Dude.
Ants?
Is it goblins?
It's not ants. It's not goblins.
Bug's Life?
Dog,
nope,
or cats.
Nope. It is spiders.
Ugh.
There are 29 million tons of spiders worldwide, and they eat 10% of their body weight. So that's the equivalent every single day. So that's the entire weight of humanity is under 300 million tons.
Yeah.
And so they can wolf down by the way, thank you, Washington Post, for all these fantastic, horrifying gifts.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. There they go.
Oh, no.
This one's pretty good, too.
No. God. They're like,
spiders. All right. So wait, this is just some math done based on on how much they eat and how many there are, right?
Correct, correct. But they like meat, and they mainly eat the other bugs is where they get all their protein. But if they ever wanted to, I mean, it just sort of puts you in your place to says
it would take approximately 2,000 pounds of spiders to consume a 200-pound man in one day.
2,000 pounds of spiders?
2,000 pounds of spiders to consume a 200-pound man.
How have we at least not seen this in a movie, right? Like, there's always different, like, people have, like, pigs eat bodies and stuff like that, like, in Snatch. Like, how has there not been, at least in the movies, like, somebody like, I'll leave you to my spiders. Like, no, boss, no, I didn't mean to. Pop.
I think it's because spiders have a pretty good rep. I'm much more terrified of ants getting together and taking over humanity because ants are straight up carnivores. They take carcasses and they shred that. You know, you've seen that decomposing frog.
Oh, the movie Ants?
With Woody Allen.
It's like, kill that frog.
Yeah, that biting wit. It's just, you know, that soul crushing conformity. It's insane.
Oh my God, I'm a carnivore. I don't know. Sylvester Stallone.
No, they ate a frog?
I
haven't seen
that. Yeah, time lapse, ants eating frog.
Frog time lapse, sure.
Oh, we probably don't need to watch
that. We
probably don't. This is a gecko.
Yeah, here, go, a whole gecko.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Like this is just in a few hours, them eating a whole gecko.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
All right, here we go. So we got a dead gecko. And then look at how fast they strip all that. I think in the war between ants... Who would win in a war between ants and spiders?
Between ants and spiders?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, ants are known for having a lot of proportionally...
Teamwork, right?
Yeah, teamwork and having a high proportional strength.
So they are strength. Just swarming this thing.
Ooh.
Already seeing the tail kind of a fracture off. This is the time elapsed that we are narrating.
So they're actually playing with the bones.
They're playing the spine like a xylophone. It's adorable.
Oh my goodness, this is the world's worst marching band.
I gotta tell you, I feel like ants would win
over humanity.
Well, I mean, obviously,
no.
I mean, like the,
or
the,
over
the,
spiders.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean the colony thing is no joke, right? So they are probably more direct to like once the colony is on devouring something, it's done.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably easier for ants to bite spiders than it is for spiders to bite ants, just because of the size. Because
the numbers, right?
Well, even just the size.
Yeah, if a spider it's like their fangs is like they're practically squishing the ants.
Yeah, but also, spiders have webs.
How is ants versus spiders like not like a preteen boy like cartoon franchise? Like that seems like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, right. You got the conformists,
Ninja Turtles. Like,
yeah, dude. This is. I think we got a property in the works here.
TM 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 TM.
Yeah. Right. Or at least a Sci-Fi Week movie.
See, that sounds like a Sharknado style. Ants versus spiders.
I'm okay with that.
And it's but you do it like a Ninja Turtles thing, where like you know one of them's like a nerd and the other one's like a cool guy. And,
you know, the spider's got to be like the punk rock, you know, wearing eight pairs of sunglasses, and it's just like whatever, man. I'm gonna hang out over here in my web. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, all those ants are like, we do what we're told. We are ants. We get old. Obey the queen.
Oh, jeez.
And then, you know, he's like, whatever. My mom was Charlotte.
You're putting spiders as the good guys?
I think so. They're the nonconformist, right?
They're also way bigger.
Like, yeah.
It's hard to root against the tiny guy.
Right. It's an underdog story. It's an under ant story.
But the ants are the more formidable force.
But if you're posing them as the geeks, as the geeks who learn the power of friendship and squad based tactics.
Okay. Well, we talked about this. I want to say like 6 years ago. I brought up the question because the amount of biomass of ants is equivalent to or superior to humans. Like if ants had it in their mind to just take on humans, I don't think we would beat them. I think they would defeat us. Like we would have to come up with some crazy ass sprays to make safe zones. Like,
if we're talking about tools,
a hot air balloon.
Hot air balloons. Also.
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
But if you get one of them on that air balloon, you're screwed because he's gonna make a rip and that just grows and grows.
True. That's true. We'd also
terrorists, Bryce. They're not just like, they're not like land the balloon. Like you know,
no, I'm not saying he pulls out a gun, land the balloon. Like But we have spray. We have technology to kill.
I think not enough, though. I mean, it's like.
But if we're in a warring situation, I think we have the time to turn around.
Man,
some
in
of
a
those.
World where they could just dig underneath everything and come up from the ground, like I can't think of anything that's truly ant proof.
But how many ants have read The Art of War?
Dude, they wrote half of The Art of War is just Sun Tzu looking at ants and be like, well, it seems like they figured this out. Mm-hmm. I'm on team ants.
Step three in The Art of War, obey the queen.
So you're pro ants in Ants versus Humans.
And certainly pro ants in Ants versus Spiders.
What say you, Justin? In both, Ants versus Humans.
No, you got to go, because, Brian, you're absolutely right, but that's the story arc, and that's why these ants are special, is that they're not, you know, following the queen, and maybe they're ostracized as bad ants, right? These are our good ants.
Renegade ants.
But the villain has to be the spiders. They look less like humans.
Yeah. Right?
Like, they look more like monsters. They're bigger than the ants, and the ants got to use teamwork to defeat them. Come on, put this thing on Netflix.
I feel like you're a movie producer and you're like, you know, we tested spiders, too many legs. They got too many legs. Six legs, we can handle that.
But I would love for you to like be watching this, like my version of the cartoon. The girls are watching it on Netflix and you're like, I don't get it. The ants are more conformist, sweetheart. Like, why are they the good guy?
They sing a song like, doing what you're told makes you strong. Let's all go and get along.
Well, except them. We're fighting them.
Yeah. Yeah. What if all the ostracized ants, like, they're all like, oh, nobody likes us. We need a queen. And then the spider pulls off his, you know, eight pairs of sunglasses and like, I'll be your queen. It's like, what?
It's spider queen? Yeah. For ants.
Exactly. And it's like, we'll just do what you say.
The evil ants, yeah.
And then they start recruiting, and they make like an epic alternate colony like they splinter off.
That's season two. It's season two. We can't even touch that until the end of season one. You know, there's an evil queen, and she gets defeated, and then the villainous spider becomes the queen.
You're setting up one of those, like, Animal Planet, animal documentary reality shows.
Oh, one of those like Meerkat Manor kind of jobs. Yeah,
the evil queen Tanisha moves in.
Tanisha.
All right, let's not get in trouble here.
I've watched Real Housewives shows. Shut up.
You're speaking from experience. Yes, I got it. All right.
they have a little tiny glasses of wine that they throw at each other. I do think ants versus spiders, ants would win. But I feel like human ingenuity and good old, you know, USA, American get it done, could we kill some animals extinct.
What country goes down first?
I think heavy casualties, man. I think heavy casualties.
Yeah.
I think we lose.
I got my money. I got my money on Vatican City. It might be a hack, but like there's not a lot of people there. Sorry about the Pope, but that's going to be the first country to be fallen by ants.
Man, you don't think like a country where all the ants already are, like, you know, the city of Brasilia? I feel like the city of Brasilia is the first one to go.
City is not a country, but that's fine.
No, but I'm going to say, like, the city of Brasilia, like it cuts to the mayor and he's just like, I told them 30 years ago, don't build a city in the middle of the rainforest. It's insane.
Like, if you go around here screaming ants, we're going to have nobody here on Labor Day.
Mandibles coming this summer.
Mandibles.
I know. You don't want to have that Kittner boy being eaten over the course of 8 hours all over the docks.
All right. So ants are going to eat us all. Who could? Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, I don't know, maybe we should get this guy who wrote this blog piece and really put it to him. Like, if spiders can do it at this point, how much faster could ants do it?
Should we reach out to this person?
There's a couple of people on who published this Arthropods of the Great Indoors: Characterizing Diversity Inside Urban and Suburban Homes.
Wait, is this where this little factoid came from The Washington Post?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We can hit up Matthew.
I think we should reach out to him, and I'm sure they're going to be very excited for us, you know, to just in Comic Sans be like, okay, but could ants do it faster?
I'll be sure to use that font.
Yeah.
All right, we got a couple other stories here. I don't know. I think we're about to have to roll up on picks.
We got some time.
Two stories.
Okay.
One, and this one is teased by the headline, Tourist Rescued by Monkeys. And this is
a feel-good story.
Yeah, it doesn't feel real good when you read the circumstances.
Set us up.
So in Bolivia, there is the Madidi National Park, the crown jewel of Bolivia's protected rainforests.
Mm. And Madidi.
There's a bunch of tour agencies that that take people and escort them in and take them on tours and stuff. They've in 20 years they've not had anyone go missing or whatever. And it's a wild story. This is on NationalGeographic.com because this guy named Maykool, Maykool, just freaked out one night. And keep in mind, there's the people who are running the park. And then there's a couple of shamans. And the shamans show up.
Who, like, reside in the park?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, their job is to connect with the local rainforest spirits or whatever.
Yeah.
And so they're getting ready for, like, essentially a party. It was reminiscent. This disappearance was reminiscent of a famous case from 1981 when an Israeli tourist, Yossi Ginsberg, was deceived by a fellow traveler and stranded in the Bolivian rainforest for 3 weeks. His account of deception and survival was turned into the international bestseller Back from Tuichi, which will be coming out as a movie called Jungle starring Daniel Radcliffe later this year.
Ooh.
So this is very, very similar to that. So
is this just native marketing?
Yeah, it could be. That'd be a hell of a way to go.
News.
So the circumstances of his disappearance is
freaks out one night.
Yes, but specifically the night that the shamans want to have this party. It's basically show up with armfuls of cigarettes, cans of beer, glitter confetti,
yeah,
like Mylar glitter confetti, and one other thing, I assume drugs, all designed to let them commune with the rainforest spirits, right?
Yeah.
So the shamans are like, come on, man, let's honor this thing. And he is just feeling weird. He's like, nah, man, I'm not going to do it. And then he ends up running off into the woods while they have their party, right? Dude's gone. The next next day
doesn't come back.
They don't find him, right? And so they go and here's the amazing part is there. It's the tale of two search parties. On the one hand, you have the people who run the parks, the rangers, where what they do is they form a giant coalition and then they go linearly sector by sector.
Square by square, right?
Yeah, exactly, right. And then on the other side, you have the team of the two shamans. We're just going to get baked and try to get the rainforest to help them, to spit them out.
Lost compatriot is.
Exactly. And so and they said it's because he offended the Pachamama. He didn't want to participate in the ceremony. That's why they said he had vanished. Right. And so days and days later, like almost a week later, they have a break in the case when they find his sock. And then they bring the sock back because at this point, and by the way, this guy was a tourist from Chile. And so his family has come out to help. And they're like, what's going on? They're like, do you recognize the sock? They're like, yes, that's his sock. Mm-hmm.
Legendary sock.
At which point the shamans go, oh, this will help immensely. And they grab the sock. And they're like, now we have a clear connection to him.
They hold it up for the spirits to smell.
Exactly. And they say, oh, starting now, the forest will make sure to take care of him.
Okay, wait a minute. Hold on, wait. How long is this going on? Because he's at the family. This is...
The whole thing was a 9-day ordeal.
So the shamans are like, all right, man, we're burning the midnight oil here. And they're like, wait, are you doing ayahuasca again? It's like, hey... I don't come to your job and tell you what to do, okay?
Yes.
Like, what? This is my profession.
Yes.
Any lip balm?
And so eventually they find him. Get this. They find him less than a mile away from camp. And I guess that's a testament to just how hard it is to find anything in the rainforest, right?
So I'd be pissed. At that point, I would be like, you were this close?
Wait, tell me, he's alive. He's alive. 9 days later.
Yeah, 9 days later, found alive, less than a mile away from camp.
I like to think he just kept going back to camp, but nobody was there because they were out searching for him.
I don't know.
Like, so, oh man, the camp's pretty quiet right now. I'm gonna get a Pepsi.
Well, so at this point, I assume the story doesn't say, but at this point, I assume the shamans say, "You're welcome." but basically, the guy. Tell me what this sounds like to you, because it sounds like there's something. He said that he was lost out in the woods, and then the night before he got rescued, he said, "Yesterday, when I really made a promise to God, I got on my knees, asked him with my heart to get me out of here." And then he said, "I started." Mekul revealed that the night he disappeared, strange, terrible thoughts had begun to creep into his mind. He said he had an irresistible urge to get out of the rainforest. He says, "I started running. I was wearing sandals, and I said, no, they would slow me down. So I threw away the sandals, then the cell phone, what? And my flashlight.
Huh?
After running so much, I stopped under a tree, and I started thinking, what had I done? What was I doing?
That was bad.
And when I wanted to get back, it wasn't possible."
Oh.
What does that sound like to you, Justin?
This sounds like somebody who was communing with the forest and eventually he got hold of the wrong stuff.
he was pre-ceremoning.
He was pre-communing with the spirits.
So wait, wasn't this a monkey story? Doesn't he befriends a monkey or something? Or
yeah, the monkey tie-in is he says that he was kept alive because once he was out there, he would just follow a group of monkeys that would, you know, they would grab fruit and they would eat some and they'd throw the rest down. And so he just followed them everywhere. And they were apparently chill. And at some point he realized, like, this is not sustainable. I've got to make it home. But he spent like a good week just following the monkeys and eating their leftovers. And they, I guess they were curious about, like, well, what's this one? Oh, that's weird.
Let me just say this. Living in the Bay Area, there are a lot of people that go into Central and South America and do these healing retreats with ayahuasca. This is something that is a well-known, it's a thing. It is a tourist thing. I don't presume to make any, he looks happy. He looks really pumped.
Yeah, the first thing he said is that he wanted a Coca-Cola, which made me think native advertising.
they dropped him fruit and led him to shelter and water every day. The monkeys.
Wow.
That sounds like he might have gotten a little aggressive on the first shamanistic ritual, and then got a little freaked out when he saw a shadow move the wrong way.
Yeah. Well, and I get, my guess is he's also probably not the first to have a little too much of enlightenment. And my guess is that the folks who run the tourism agency were just like, one got away. Yeah, like we get some runners every year.
Well, I mean, listen, but he went full bore, man. He tossed his cell phone. He tossed his flashlight. Like, you know, when you are out of those two things, it is easy to get lost in an actual legit, like, non-humanitized part of the world, you know,
yeah, especially the rainforest. He allegedly was looking for a river because, you know, that's the saw is like, if you find a river, you could just follow it and you can always find the ocean or something down the way, right? Mm-hmm. But he never found a river.
Oh, man.
Which, you want to know what? The next time you're freaking out, find the river before you get rid of your flashlight and your cell phone. You know, toss them in the river just so you can make sure, you know, that they're not useful to you anymore. But go ahead and find that body of water first. The way that the state that we're presuming he was in, he might have found a water fountain and just, you know, confused it.
I have one more item on the ancient scroll.
Okay.
Of Andrew. Uh-huh. This one. Okay. Authorities say they've charged a Florida man, recorded on video, sitting in the street eating blank.
Oh, well, it's got to be a little weird if it made the news, so it ain't going to be nothing like a bunch of pork rinds from the Piggly Wiggly. It ain't going to be, anything like a bucket of chicken. I'm going to say, do we go macabre and say like an animal that you're not supposed to eat, like maybe a dog?
Now, keep in mind, this guy got arrested. Like, apparently what happened was he was blocking traffic and people described the situation and they're like, what? Okay. And then by the time the authorities got there, he was already gone. And then a video of this crime of blocking traffic while eating this substance surfaces on Facebook. And then Lou at the crime lab says, well, I think we can put this one to bed, boys. I think we've solved it.
Well, the way that you're laughing makes me not think that it's like a dog or something really gross and weird, that it really isn't man bites dog.
Correct. It's not horrific by any stretch.
Did he end up getting arrested after the fact?
Yeah. Yeah. They're all wow. Like, well, we got the reports and thank you for the evidence. You've now posted on Facebook and they've charged him with the exact crime is they charged him with placing an obstruction in the roadway and disrupting the free flow of traffic. He was not arrested, but issued an April 25th court date.
Bryce, any guesses?
I know what it is. I actually got to look at the ancient scrolls a little bit earlier today.
lay it on me. Lay it
all
on
right
me.
Here. Let's just play the video. And Justin, you can narrate for the audio minded.
Here we go. Well, there's just a person. He's literally sitting at a table in the center. I mean, the table's what sells it, and it looks like a plate, right?
Yep.
Is it cereal?
He's eating pancakes with syrup.
He's just literally sitting there. A guy, he's wearing his green pants. Now the man who's taking the video is making his way a little bit closer. But he is in the center lane of a thruway in Florida. So the right and left lane can pass, but the center lane can't because he has set up a little TV dinner hutch.
Yeah, that's what's so great.
Eat pancakes.
It's a TV dinner tray and a seat. And he's got the pancakes and a bottle of syrup.
Yeah, that's sufficiently absurdist for my taste.
He does have eggs and bacon.
There he goes. Yeah, he's putting the Mrs. Butterworth right on there. I mean, I almost think that that's
native advertising
for Mrs. Butterworth.
Yeah. Syrup's so good, you'll sit in the street. Wow. I mean, I almost wonder if that's like some sort of viral, like prank, like, you know, like when you're stuck in traffic, but pancakes are life, you know, and you put that one up on IG and watch the likes rack up.
I mean, I'm betting that his whole channel is just him doing absurdist stuff and putting it up. And in this case, it whoopsie was also illegal.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, something silly, you know, like you can still get a job at the Taco Bell with that on your record. You know, have you ever been arrested? Yes. For what? Eating a pancake in the center of the street for my Instagram. Like, you know, it's like, all right, yeah, it's fine. Come on, you can chalupas.
So this was posted on Facebook. This was posted by someone who is not the man in the street. And their Facebook description of the video goes to a GoFundMe link to a local community recreation project.
Wait, so this is a jacked video?
This is viral marketing for a community project GoFundMe?
So it might be, or he might just put that. It might just be the signature.
Yeah, it sounds like he freebooted it and just put it up there.
Yeah,
yeah. Hmm. In which case, I don't want to give him no info.
Screw your community.
I mean, I guess he's the hero, right? The hero of all this.
Yeah.
Going down for what he believes in.
Pancakes. Delicious pancakes.
Not the people, Brian.
Oh, God.
He's a man of the people. And pancakes.
Hey, man. Justin, you got any picks?
Sure. I think I've already shouted this movie out, but I want to shout it out again because I watched it again on the flight to Florida. Sing Street. Either you see this movie, Sing Street.
I started watching it on an airplane. And I could tell it was good, but it wasn't at the moment. It wasn't something I wanted to watch, and I never got around back to it. But it's a nice movie.
Yeah, apparently, yeah. I guess it's exclusively shown on airplanes, because that's how I've watched it twice, and now you started to watch it. It's a 1980s story of some kid, you know, a protagonist and his friends in high school. He gets transferred to a new high school at a time when Ireland is going through a severe economic crunch. But it kind of struck me, especially in comparison to La La Land and Moonlight, both of which that I really, really liked, but I thought were kind of it was odd that it became this like big debate, like they're both perfect movies. And I think they're both kind of very far from perfect. But this movie, I think it tells a better coming of age story, although not as rare of one as Moonlight. And I think it's a little bit more complete than Moonlight. And it tells a better follow your dream story than La La Land, which is not to say that everything has to be AB, but you know, it does share DNA with both those films. And I will say this in its comparison to La La Land, a lot of people who enjoyed La La Land kind of thought that some of, you know, it really is only like three songs that they sing. And by the end of it, they just kind of reprise, you know, all three of them. This movie, by the end of it, here's spoiler, it ends with them playing a concert at their school, like, you know, you would imagine a story about a bunch of kids who make a band in high school does. But like the original songs that they do are like awesome. They're like really, really, really good. And it's an awesome story of kind of following your dreams. And also a lot of the stuff that if you have done creative stuff, you kind of empathize with, where he's trying to put this band together with his high school friends. And it's a lot of him kind of BSing what his older brother tells him about music. Like, he doesn't know anything about music. He's learning, you know, and he's a kid in high school. And it's every time he hears a new band or his brother turns him on to a new band, you know, the next scene, he's dressing like the lead singer and he wants to make his band sound like the band that he heard yesterday. And that's something that for anybody who's been in any kind of creative endeavor, especially in your adolescence, it's a very empathetic thing that the first thing you learn how to do is getting taste enough to steal from the right people, you know, and then eventually you start to come up with your own stuff, hopefully. But exceptional film. I highly recommend it. Sing Street.
Dude, I just invested 6 hours not watching the rest of Legion, much to your chagrin. Because I'm still on episode 4, Legion is still great. But I just wrapped up today the end of the 6-hour miniseries documentary on Hulu, Made in America, O.J. Simpson. It's amazing. It's really good. O.J. Made in America is what it's called. Mm-hmm. It's 8 hours long. Holy cow. 7 hours, 47 minutes broken into three videos. It is it's amazing because it does a wonderful job of setting up not only the origin story of O.J. Simpson, but also the context of what racial tensions were like and why in the arena in which that trial took place. So the first 2 or 3 hours is about the rise of O.J. Simpson, about him, you know, not wanting to engage in the, you know, Black Power movement or the race transformations that were happening, and instead just happy to be the Black person that the rich Black person that white people liked, you know. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, you know, you get the story of, you know, various riots throughout LA and the reputation that the LAPD was getting and the frustrations of that community. And then the second episode, you know, begins with the murders and whoo boy, it's real hard to not just think he's guilty as hell watching it, you know, looking at, you know, the evidence.
Well, here's what's amazing about that documentary, which, by the way, it's won the Oscar for best documentary.
Oh, it did win. Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that.
Although, by the way, that means that they screened that movie theatrically. People went to go see a movie and sat down for 6 hours.
Man, eight hours.
The theatrical cut was a little shorter.
Okay.
But this is an extended version that, I mean, because also that was like a 6-night event on ESPN and ABC. So what you're seeing is a re-edited version of that where you know, it's now just three massive videos as opposed to six. Here's what's amazing about it. They break news. You know, they've got somebody that claims firsthand to say that I was having a conversation with O.J. Simpson and he told me he did it.
Like, yeah.
That's something that nobody has said on camera before. It's something that nobody has said, you know, on other, you know, platforms before. And that's really the promise of that documentary, is that you will learn something about the O.J. Simpson trial and O.J. and L.A. that you did not know before, or O.J.'s life after, you know.
Well, that to me was the most interesting chapter. The last everything in the last thing is all post acquittal. And that is fascinating, both from, you know, the civil trial, which was not televised, so you get to hear a lot more interesting stuff that went down in there. And when they, like, the whole thing opens with OJ at, I assume, like a parole hearing or something. And that is a broken, defeated old man talking about how he cleans up garbage and coaches a team in the prison. Yeah. And one of the things... when you see – they actually – you get to listen to the recording of the crime that he committed, the armed robbery / kidnapping thing when he was trying to get back his property or whatever. You hear it and see it, and it's like, hey, man, yeah, it's messed up. I thought I was having a confrontation with my friends to get back property that they owed me. You see the judge, you watch the video of the judge reading the sentence and all that. And it goes to one of OJ's team from the 1994 trial, where he's like, yeah, you think it's a coincidence that the number that it was 33 years sentence for this, 33 being the exact $33 million being the exact civil suit settling award. You think it's coincidence that like this on a dripping wet, this is maybe a 2-year penalty. And he talks about the idea that whenever their football team would lose in high school, they said, well, we'll win it in the fifth quarter because there's only four quarters in there. But in the fifth quarter was the fights afterwards.
The parking lot. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so essentially he was just like, yeah, man, they won it in the fifth quarter. Like, this was not the crime. This was not the situation. But there is no doubt that it was straight up.
There's also a lot of insinuation that in his time in Miami that he was involved in things that probably could have gotten him caught up in stuff, he had a reputation in Miami of being involved with some pretty heinous people and kind of being this almost like dark crime figure. Listen, it's a fascinating story. My favorite element of it is something that you see not only in, and Brian, I'm excited. Have you seen the FX, the dramatization that came out around the same time?
You know what's funny is I clicked play on it, and then I was like, wait, no, there's the better one, and I stopped it, and I went to go watch the other one. So I'm hesitant to watch the dramatization.
What now that you have the one, watch an American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson. That's like, I read the book that's based on, which covers a lot of the stuff that's in the People versus O.J. Simpson, but I would recommend you watch it while the other one is fresh, because they're not trying to be the same thing,
right?
You know, that one is trying to be a dramatization, but there is a point that is described or played out in one and played out in the other, which is something that I did not remember. Marcia Clark is one of the things that she is fuming and furious about, is that the defense redecorated OJ's home when the jurors were coming to visit it to examine it as evidence, basically.
Because the entire house was filled with nothing but OJ surrounded by white people. And so they
golf pictures and him with white celebrities and him with hot white chicks and his girlfriend at the time. When the jurors got there, it was all pictures of his family and, like, you know, this tribal African art and stuff like that. And the defense attorney, whose name escapes me, but the one who mentions the fifth quarter at the end of the documentary, this is the People or the Made in America, makes no bones about the fact that if OJ were Mexican and he has this great delivery, it's like, oh, yeah, we would have had a mariachi band in the lobby.
We'd all be wearing sombreros. Yeah, it was amazing.
It's great. It tells a fantastic story of just what that moment in time was like. And I would also recommend American Crime Story, just because, again, it's a dramatization, but man, it'll get you right in the 90s nostalgia feels. And There's some really, really great performances, and it kind of brings out a lot more of the over the top element to it, because where Made in America is all about how can this happen in real life, this is all about this is what it felt like.
Yeah.
You know, this is the drama, the fact that all these people are, you know, civil servants on Monday and international celebrities on Tuesday, and kind of the birth of sort of the celebrity industrial complex in LA, right down to the fact that the Kardashians are involved.
Yeah. Right on. Wow. Bryce, do you have a pick?
I do. The past like week or two, one of a remake of what I've considered my favorite science fiction property ever was released. Originally, it was a set of games on a bunch of different consoles. So, like, the first game was on the old Nintendo DS, and then the second one was on the PlayStation Vita and the 3DS, and then the third one came out, and that was on the computer and stuff. And it was a tough thing to recommend because I love it so much. And so they finally re-released the first two games as a PC like pack, remastered pack. Mm-hmm. So now you can play all of them on the PC or on the PlayStation, I think. It's called Zero Escape. The series is called Zero Escape. The pack is called the Nonary Games. And the idea is that each game sets up a scenario where you and nine or so other people wake up with some form of amnesia and are put in these different situations in which killing each other is a requisite to survive. So in the first game, you wake up on a sinking sinking cruise liner, a sinking ship, and you have to find these different doors and use the digital routes, the mathematical digital route of the numbers that are on your bracelets to get through these doors. And, you know, the second game is all about the second game is all about colors. You have different colors in on your bracelets, and the numbers and the colors have to match up to different things. And then the third game takes place in a Mars simulation mission of what it would be like if humanity went to Mars.
So it takes place on Earth, but they're like practicing to be on Mars.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And they all have these really great meta narratives that go in through all of them. And it was it used to be really tough to recommend any of these games to people because they were so console based and they're just not as accessible. And so now that these first two games have been released, now you can all play them on more accessible consoles. But they're really great in a way that I think not a lot of games can tell a good story that involves the player, the person playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're reading a book, there are I can't imagine very many plots that involve the reader necessarily as like you are also a part of the story. It's partially because it's pre-written,
right?
But also because you are almost necessarily reading about something that's happening. And video games have a very interesting ability to make you a player in these universes, not just as the player character, but also as yourself, your human self. And all three of the entries in this game set up a lot of really interesting perspectives for not just the characters and not just how the characters interact between games and throughout time, but also yourself as a player character. In fact, my favorite bit of the whole series is actually something that ended up being retconned out. At the end of one of the games, you get a really fun epilogue of like, hey, here's what these people are doing now, sort of. But everyone has got this very scanty pants look at you of like, well, what are you, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but
okay.
It sets up a really cool thing of the player character also being an entity in this world,
right,
that they never fully address, but is also still plausible. It is a game that is a series of twists and loops and intricacies of these death games that are often more than they appear. They're not about killing nine people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
And that's fascinating in the way that they all escalate in terms of stakes also. You know, you're going from saving a couple dozen people to saving a number of people I don't even want to mention.
Got it.
It's really fantastic. And I I want to go and play this again because
how long of a playthrough is it, do you think? What kind of investment am I looking at?
So most of the levels are like escape the room sort of puzzle style things, and then you have decisions. So it kind of goes back and forth between an escape room and like a visual novel where you're making choices. Mm-hmm. So I would say like the third game is probably 8 hours. I'd say they're all about 8 hours or so.
Oh, each. That's perfect. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're really great. It's not even $60 now, these first two games. But that's Zero Escape, the Nonary games. I can't. I want to talk to people about it because it's so good.
You need
and
to I manufacture said, friends.
Play it so Bryce can talk about it.
It was tough, too, because after that second game came out, they were like, we don't know if we're going to make a third one. And the very end of the second one
is very much a cliffhanger.
Sets up the third game in no uncertain terms. And you're like, oh, give me a brochure or something. Tell me what's going to So, you know, that they're done and are all in one place is really great.
Awesome. Dude, that's very cool. Yeah. How's it been, Justin?
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.